From Reading to Understanding. Commentary for the January 4, 2020 Sabbath School Lesson. Our guiding verse for this commentary is John 14:6. Jesus answered, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." In 1869, a few short years after the American Civil War, Pope Pius IX convened Vatican I in Rome to deal with several pressing issues within the Roman Catholic Church. Several centuries had passed since the most recent council had met in Trent. One of the foremost issues on the agenda at this council was advancing the doctrine that Mary, the mother of Jesus, was herself immaculately conceived and therefore also without sin, which enabled her to bear a son without sin. Of course, this begs a question of how this could be if Mary's mother was not also immaculately conceived. But for some reason, that was not recognized as a valid reason to challenge the idea of Mary's posthumous promotion. However, since there is no biblical mention of Mary being immaculately conceived, this could only be established by papal decree. This brought up the related issue as to whether or not the Pope could be considered infallible in his decisions. There was a strong argument against this because of Pope Honorius I. In the 7th century, Honorius, confronted by a squabble between two factions quarreling over whether Christ's will consisted of separate human and divine wills, or simply one divine will, decided to favor one faction over the other in order to quell the argument, but without consulting both factions. Later popes and councils condemned his decision as erroneous. Popes then were therefore arguably not infallible. In order to firmly establish the new doctrine about Mary, this had to be dealt with. In the end, it was decided that the Pope was indeed infallible, but only when speaking ex cathedra, by declaring that Honorius was not, but the current Pope was. The issue was resolved, and not only the Marian doctrine was established, but the manner of papal infallibility as well. By declaring his speech to be ex cathedra, the Pope could now establish irrefutable doctrine by fiat, firmly establishing the hierarchical nature of the Church as an entity with a sinful, yet paradoxically infallible, human being in charge. This is peculiarly significant as we begin this quarter study in the book of Daniel, for the introductory lesson appears to closely parallel the issues that faced Vatican I, with a similar solution being offered up. Much of what is to come in the quarter is going to depend heavily on references to Ellen White's writings as authoritative declarations regarding doctrine, especially when we examine chapters 8 and 9. These chapters have often been interpreted in unique ways that bolster a singular understanding of the Millerite movement that brought together believers from various denominations in the 1840s to prepare for the Parousia. While that didn't take place, some of those believers united in their search for answers to why the great disappointment of 1844 happened. And 2 decades later, they formed the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Key to their understanding and theological development were writings by Ellen White, acknowledged by the fledgling Adventists as prophetic. The degree to which the denomination recognized her prophetic gift vacillated from time to time. At one point, the church sent her off to Australia in order to lessen her influence, which they felt was interfering with church administrators in the United States. While this resulted in positive changes, such as the establishment of Avondale College in Australia, it also demonstrated that not everyone was in full recognition of any sort of infallibility regarding Ellen's prophetic gift. To complicate matters, she also said that she was not infallible. 2 examples of her declarations regarding her infallibility may be found in Letter 27, written in 1876, and in Selected Messages, Book 1, pages 415 and 37. It did not help support a position of infallibility when she also used selections in her inspired writings taken verbatim from other authors, and those originally uncited quotes were at times found to be factually in error. While this was consistent with her stated position on infallibility, it did not sit well with those who wished to use her writings as an authoritative source to provide indisputable commentary on the Bible. They needed her to be infallible in order to have that authority. This is sometimes expressed in conversation by individuals whenever a question is raised about her biblical interpretation, with the response being given, "Don't you believe in Ellen White?" The implication made is that one cannot be a faithful Seventh-day Adventist without accepting the infallibility of Ellen White. There is an underlying reason for this to be the case that goes beyond commonly discussed issues, such as vegetarianism, eating cheese, or Christmas celebrations. A key doctrine of Seventh-day Adventism is the investigative judgment. The belief that judgment of mankind began in 1844 and is continuing until the parousia. While there is little support for this biblically, Ellen White supported the idea in her writings. In all fairness, like some of her other sources she cited, the idea did not begin with her prophetic gift, but was instead proposed to the early Adventists by a faith healer, Hiram Edson. But her support of his interpretation has created a dilemma. If she is fallible, then the idea of the investigative judgment can be re-examined and is open for revision or even rejection. But the church officially denied that possibility at Glacier View Ranch, Colorado, in 1980, where they defrocked theologian Desmond Ford for suggesting such a re-examination. A line in the sand had been drawn regarding the infallibility of Ellen White, and several others were purged from church offices, both clergy and laity, over the issue. Nonetheless, not all could be dealt with in this attempt to silence the issue. Those who held no church office or denominational employment could not be coerced into abandoning their concerns. And defrocking Desmond Ford actually allowed him the freedom to continue to speak and publish without fear of retribution. But even apart from his influence, members began to question these things on their own and coming at the issue from several different perspectives. They found that the issue of prophetic infallibility was ripe for examination. This has brought us to the current crossroads that the Quarterly's first lesson seeks to resolve. Instead of Mary's Immaculate Conception, substitute the doctrine of the investigative judgment. Both are equally questionable, as both are based on little or no biblical support and a desire to resolve a theological dilemma. In the first instance, how could a sinful woman conceive a sinless Savior? And in the second, how could the apparent failure of William Miller's predicted second advent be explained? In each instance, an alternative authoritative source was needed, and in order to quell all dissension, that source needed to be infallible. The solution for the Catholic Church was to create a conditional infallibility for papal authority. Our lesson reveals that the Seventh-day Adventist Church is apparently wanting to establish the same for Ellen White. Elias Brazil de Souza, writing as a representative of the Biblical Research Institute of the General Conference, divides prophecy into two categories. What he calls classical prophecy is conditional and therefore not infallible. This would be equivalent to the treatment of the decision made by Honorius I as fallible based on the conditional aspects of its development. The second category, apocalyptic prophecy, D'Souza maintains is infallible. This is essentially saying that when Ellen White is speaking apocalyptically, she is infallible, just like when the Pope is speaking ex cathedra. Of course, the end result is also equivalent. The Church is seeking to bolster its ability to quell all dissent, no matter how weak the doctrine might be, not by evidentiary means, but by authority alone. Whenever the Church has claimed such authority, truth has been made subject to power, and persecution of those seeking truth may be sought to the limit of what civil authority allows. In fact, it is precisely this desire to assert authority that creates a temptation for the Church to go so far as to seek the intervention of civil authority to enforce its decrees. As Adventists, we have long been concerned about the manifestation of such authority as represented in the symbolism of Revelation, especially in chapter 13. We often claim that the government is going to do all these things, even claiming that the lamb-like beast in that chapter is the United States government. But in doing so, we fail to recognize the lessons of history that reveal it is the church that asks the government to grant it civil authority to persecute, not the other way around. When we establish infallible hierarchical authorities within our denominations, we are building the foundation for such a possibility. We point our fingers at other religions and how they have such control of their governments that they oppress and even kill those who dissent. But we fail to see that our desire for the government to enforce religious belief is fruit from the same tree. In spite of this quarter's lessons and the direction it wishes to take us, perhaps now is a good time to begin questioning that direction and whether it is good for the denomination and for us personally to go down that road.